What?
College matters.
What?
College matters. Matters.
Really?
For sure. College matters.
Alma matters. Matters.
I remember the defeats really acutely. Mm-hmm. I remember all the awards I applied for and didn't win. I remember those things. And I have to work hard to really make sure that I'm focusing on the positives and taking the wins and mm-hmm. feeling and living in that moment when that experiment really works out that I've been working hard on. And mm-hmm. When that problem set that I was focused on, or when that, oh man, when that introduction or that conclusion to an essay really comes mm-hmm. together that you've been really laboring over and thinking about, you know, I think it's easy to kind of blow past the wins and the positives. Yeah.
That is Dr. Anna Quidder, a Goldwater Scholar, a Marshall Scholar, who graduated with a bachelor's degree in physics and astronomy and religious studies and the history and philosophy of science from the University of Pittsburgh. Hello, I'm your host, Venkat Raman. Anna enjoyed learning in high school. When she was in the eighth grade, in her earth science class, the teacher told the class that the universe is expanding. This fact completely captivated Anna and launched her interest in astronomy and physics in high school. She did science projects for the Western New York science fairs and fell in love with the scientific process. Anna was socially engaged in school as well. Her crowning achievement was being a high school valedictorian and being voted senior prom queen. Anna joins us on our podcast to share her University of Pittsburgh undergraduate journey, her interest in astronomy, undergraduate research on quasars, winning the Goldwater Scholarship, being a Marshall Scholar, a career in policy, and her advice for high schoolers. Now, before we jump into the podcast, here are the high fives, five highlights from the podcast.
Of course, I was active in the life of my departments, but I also was very involved with the University of Pittsburgh Honors College, which mm-hmm. now is called the Frederick Honors College. Mm-hmm. And it was just such a wonderful, welcoming community within a community. And mm-hmm. it really, I think that it gave me some of the benefits of being at a smaller school where folks really know you. You have a lot of opportunities for deep, enriching relationships and conversations and small class size coursework. I received just a single sheet of paper application to the University of Pittsburgh in the mail. And mm-hmm. I just had to submit some basic information about myself. And based on that information, I was invited to apply for the Chancellor Scholarship. And so as soon as somebody starts offering you right out of the gate the opportunity to apply for a full room board tuition scholarship, you really sit up and say, hey, wait a minute, what are they doing down there in Pittsburgh? My understanding of the story goes that after, you know, a month or 6 weeks of this, this astronomy uh-huh. professor started going around the department saying, look, I've got this girl. This lady is really keen on astronomy. Will somebody please give her a project so that she's occupied and doesn't just keep spending all of her time in my astronomy class, in my astronomy office hours, asking me a million questions? My understanding is that that's my Goldwater, the financial piece of it, kind of went into like resources to support me as a student. So mm-hmm. that's beneficial. Mm-hmm. But I would argue though, perhaps for me, even more importantly, it really, it gave me confidence as a scientist. It's gonna be okay, all right? I am working mm-hmm. in a career. I didn't even know that the job that I have existed, even when I was doing my PhD.
These were the high fives brought to you by
College Matters.
Alma Matters.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For my newsletter, visit almamatters.substack.com. Now, I'm sure you want to hear the entire podcast with Anna. So without further ado, here is Dr. Anna Quidder. So if you're ready, we can jump right in.
Sure. Well, I just would like to say thank you so much for having me here today, and I'm excited for our conversation.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Cool. So maybe the best place to start is talk a little bit about your overall undergrad experience at Pitt. I thought maybe that's a good place to start.
Sure. So I entered the University of Pittsburgh in 2002 as a freshman, and I entered on their Chancellor Scholarship, which is a full room board tuition scholarship. So I was very fortunate to have that opportunity. And I stayed at the University of Pittsburgh for 5 years because I was able to do a BA-BS combo. And so I studied for my Bachelor of Science in Physics and Astronomy, as well as a Bachelor of Arts with dual degrees, dual majors in Religious Studies and the History and Philosophy of Science. And while I was there, of course, I was active in the life of my departments, but I also was very involved with the University of Pittsburgh Honors College, which now is called the Frederick Honors College. And it was just such a wonderful, welcoming community within a community. And it really, I think that it gave me some of the benefits of being at a smaller school where folks really know you. You have a lot of opportunities for deep, enriching relationships and conversations and small class size coursework and very diverse set of coursework. But you're at a large research, I was at a large research institution where I had access to cutting edge research facilities and the wide breadth of programming that I was interested in with following my curiosity as a student.
Before we dive in further there, why did you choose the University of Pittsburgh?
You know, it's one of those things where, if I'm being totally honest, it really wasn't on my radar. I went to a public high school in Grand Island, New York, where I'm from, and according to our records, no student had ever gone to Pitt until I went to Pitt. And in fact, there were myself and two students from my graduating high school class who went to Pitt. And so how I became aware of Pitt is I had just filled in a lot of applications for Ivy League schools and other types of higher education institutions. And, you know, the kind of applications where you have to condense your soul into 250 words and, you know, really try and figure out what's the meaning of who you are and where you want to be and all this stuff. Right. And at the time, I received just a single sheet of paper application to the University of Pittsburgh in the mail. And I just had to submit some basic information about myself. And based on that information, I was invited to apply for the Chancellor Scholarship. And so as soon as somebody starts offering you right out of the gate the opportunity to apply for a full room board tuition scholarship, you really sit up and say, hey, wait a minute, what are they doing down there in Pittsburgh? What's going on? Now, of course, and I want to be clear, now the application for the University of Pittsburgh is one of those where you have to write essays and it's you know, online. I mean, I'm dating myself. This is all happening 20 years ago. As soon as I started looking into the University of Pittsburgh, though, I fell in love with the city of Pittsburgh. I fell in love with the very urban campus. The campus is just right intermixed with the city. It was really important to me to be able to study astronomy as an undergraduate student. And so I was really excited that I could actually major in physics and astronomy because I knew coming out of high school that I knew I loved physics, but I was especially interested in astronomy. So having that option at the undergraduate level was really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, something that really connected with me was when I went for my interview for the Chancellor Scholarship, the dean at the time I had been there, you know, I had driven down with my mom and I was walking around campus all day. So I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And the dean at the time, who unfortunately has passed away, but when I, you know, I'm like coming up to my interview time and I actually didn't know that he was the dean, but he comes up and talks to me and he mentioned that he's the dean and are you ready for your interview? And I said, oh, yeah, but I have to go get changed. Just give me like a few minutes. And he, and because, you know, I'd had like a backpack with like my suit in it, you know, and he looks at me and he says, well, changing your clothes change who you are. And I said, I really hope not, you know? And so he said, well, then don't worry about it. Like, I mean, if you feel more comfortable, you can, but I mean, if you're fine doing this in jeans and a t-shirt, go for it. And so that really connected with me when it came time to make decisions.
Yeah.
You know, a place that really wanted me to show up as I am and who I am. And I can say that culture still persists today because I'm now on the external advisory board for the Frederick Honors College at Pitt. So I know that, that culture still persists. But yeah, those were some of the reasons that I decided to choose the University of Pittsburgh.
So you mentioned high school. So what were you like in high school? What were your interests? What kinds of things were you into?
You know, I always think it's a funny thing to ask a person to kind of reflect on themselves in high school, you know, because so much of high school, you know, your perception of yourself may be different than how other people perceived you or, you know, et cetera. But I would say in high school, you know, and also in high school, who I was in ninth grade is different than who I was in 12th grade.
Absolutely.
You know,
so
I can tell you the story of kind of who I became in high school.
Sure.
And who I became in high school was somebody who's very curious. I mean, I've always been really curious, but you know, I'm one of those students where I loved all of my classes. I really just enjoy learning. So that led to a lot of angst because whenever I would try to figure out, you know, you're always asking students, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would be like, I don't know. And I would ask all my teachers and I would get that answer of, well, you'll be good at whatever you do. You can do, you know, and you're like, come on, just tell me, should I be a doctor? Should I be an engineer? Like, what should I do? So anyways, though, so I was very academically motivated, but I also was very involved in clubs. So I participated in a wide range of clubs, and my high school was fortunate to have a wide range of clubs. So I did things like I was on the stage crew for the musical. The high school. I was the treasurer of the drama club. I was in a singing group that met, a jazz singing group that met before school. But I also was involved with the international club, where we were the club that would welcome international exchange students, and we would try and create and experience international cultures as we could in my high school. I also was a competitive public speaker through the DECA club, the business club. And and I tried out a number of other things as well. You know, I tried out like things you might think an academically inclined student would do, like the quiz bowl club and, and it turns out I do not like those things. Like I don't like that pressure. I don't like the, you know, I don't know. I don't like that type of competition, but I figured that out about myself in high school. And so I was on a lot of clubs and also, you know, I really was very socially engaged. And in fact, I ended up at the end of 12th grade, I ended up the high school valedictorian. So top of my class, but I also was voted senior prom queen. And I think you don't see that combination too often. I think that I was voted senior prom queen because I worked really hard to build friendships and relationships across the school. And I, you know, I was in a lot of different clubs with a lot of different kinds of students. I didn't just live in my little, you know, honors class bubble. And I think that that really was an enriching part of my high school experience for me. And, you know, ended up with kind of that vote of confidence from my peers.
Now, you mentioned science and astronomy. When did that interest start, or how do you remember how you got excited about those topics?
Yeah, so, you know, I as I mentioned, I'm always curious. So much so that there were years of my life where my family wouldn't watch a movie with me as a kid because I had so many questions. Why are they doing that? How does this work? You know? And so, you know, I always just was interested in, you know, sciences, asking questions about nature. So it kind of made sense from that regard. But I can tell you, when I knew that I was really interested in astronomy was in eighth grade, I was taking my earth science class, and there was a unit on space. And in that unit, my teacher was teaching us about how the universe is expanding. And I was just like, wait, hold the phone here. What do you mean the universe is expanding? Like, does space stretch? Or do you just like, is the space rigid and you add on to the end of it? Like, where is it expanding into? Like, what does it even mean to tell me that the universe is expanding?
Right.
And so that just kind of launched my interest in astronomy. And then the next year when I was in high school, I was one of the clubs I was in was called Odyssey of the Mind, which was led by the physics teacher. And so he had seen me reading an astronomy book, like a popular astronomy book. And he said to me, you know, like all the like science behind all that astronomy stuff is called physics. And I think you'd really like physics. And so that's how I got into physics. So that's how that happened, like in terms of my development into my interest in physics and astronomy. But then in terms of science as a process, one of the things I did was I was the first student in 20 plus years to go to the Western New York Science Fair from my high school. And so, you know, we were just a, I would call it a regular high school, no fancy, you know, at the time, again, this is 20 years ago, no like super fancy equipment or whatnot. And so I wanted to go to the science fair, but I didn't really have any models of what to do. None of my teachers really knew much about it. And so I knew I wanted to do an experiment. So my first year though, I just basically like a little report with a friend of mine. We presented it and we got a bronze medal. Then I was like, okay, now I know what I'm doing. I can do this much better. And my second time that I went, I designed an experiment where I collected different kinds of animal poop and dehydrated it in the high school chemistry lab and used it as fertilizer to grow marigolds and you know, test the efficacy of these fertilizers, of this animal poop as fertilizer. And I'll tell you, I'll never forget, I had this bucket of horse poop that I'd brought into the chemistry lab and I hadn't finished, you know, dehydrating it. And I got a call over the PA that said, would Anna Quiter please come to the chemistry lab? Her horse poop is leaking. It's so funny. So I did that and I won, you know, I really fell in love with the scientific process. And it also showed me that, you know, I was at the science fair, there's kids, students who had gone and spent a summer at some cancer research lab or working in some, you know, college lab. And it showed me though, that you can do science anywhere, right? It's a, it's a process, it's a method, it's a way of thinking. And so I really carry that with me to this day that, you know, if you're at a, you know, poop plant level of school, level of resource, you can still develop into a wonderful scientist because it's about how you approach and interact with nature and problems. It's not about what kind of, you know, fancy equipment you have.
Cool. So Anna, let's jump over to University of Pittsburgh. How did that transition from high school to college go?
Well, you know, I was a kid that didn't travel away from home very much. And so, you know, there's a story in my family about how I went over to a friend's house as for a sleepover. And I got so homesick going down the street that I had to come home early from the sleepover. And so it was a pretty big surprise to my parents when I chose to go, you know, 4 or 5 hours away to the University of Pittsburgh. So the transition, you know, academically, it went quite smooth for me. And I think that's because I was really prepared from, I had taken some AP classes in high school. And, you know, I kind of had I kind of had been expecting to go to college. So I think I was kind of familiar with how that kind of works.
Yeah.
But, you know, socially, it worked out pretty well as well, because I went into the honors college. And mm-hmm. so I immediately had people that were in a cohort with me. And yeah. so that created, you know, an opportunity to build friendships and such. But I approached college the way I did high school, in that I was like, well, let me try a bunch of different things and see how this mm-hmm. goes. And so I ended up finding my community within the Honors College. They had a undergraduate research journal. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up freshman year working on the undergraduate research journal, which I ended up over the years ultimately becoming the editor in chief of.
Mm.
And so that was, you know, again, just kind of, you know, I didn't go into college thinking, wow, I'm really interested in publishing and let me try this. It was, you know, let me pursue this. It was more, hey, I'm kind of curious about this. How does this work? I don't know. Let's try it. And if it doesn't work, then you tried it and it didn't work, right? You did an experiment.
Yeah, yeah,
that's how
yeah,
you do it.
Yeah.
So I think overall it went pretty well for me. Yeah. I mean, and I enjoyed it. I made a group of friends pretty quickly, and academically things hung together pretty quickly.
How did you find the teaching and the professors in college?
Yeah, so, you know, I was, overall, I really had a great time interacting with my professors. Mm-hmm. And so here's the thing, though, I'm super curious. So in any class that I take, the faculty member ends up knowing me because I go to office hours.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, you know, there's always an opportunity for you to get to know your professors in college, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. whether it's in a small class setting where you can, you know, interact with them directly, or if you're in a big lecture hall learning introductory physics or calculus or something, or mm-hmm. bio or organic chemistry, whatever you're learning. I had a huge introduction to modern philosophy class, for example. So huge classes don't just happen in the sciences. They happen in different yeah. Disciplines too. But there's always office hours, and you go and you meet them. And, you know, I had some really wonderful relationships with faculty, which ultimately paid dividends, mm-hmm. turns out, when I was applying for graduate school and for scholarship applications and such. But mm-hmm. I'll tell you, going to office hours is actually how I got my first undergraduate research experience.
Well,
yeah.
Since you brought it up, tell us about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So what had happened is, fall of my freshman year, right? You know, I was interested in astronomy coming out of high school. I knew I really wanted to study this. So mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand the purpose of office hours, that it was supposed to focus on, like, specifically answering questions about the content of the course.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go, so I took introductory astronomy for majors fall freshman year. So I would go to office hours, every single office hours that was offered. And like a lot of times nobody else shows up. So I just viewed that as like my hour to ask this astronomy professor every question I'd ever had in astronomy,
yeah.
which is, I mean, more power to you if that's what you want to do, you know? I mean,
yeah.
you're welcome
yeah.
to do that, right? It's your instruction time. But that's not typically how people use their office hours, but that's how I use this one. And so mm-hmm. my understanding of the story goes that after, you know, a month or 6 weeks of this astronomy uh-huh. professor started going around the department saying, look, I've got this girl. This lady is really keen on astronomy. Will somebody please give her a project so that she's occupied and doesn't just keep spending all of her time in my astronomy class, in my astronomy office hours, asking me a million questions. And so that's how I came to meet Professor Dave Turncheck and Professor Sandhya Rao in uh-huh. the Quasar Research Group. And uh-huh. so November of my freshman year, I went and had an interview with them, and we hit it off. They, you know, they studied spectra. So like light that's gone through a fancy type of prism mm-hmm. from galaxies that are really far away.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to understand the chemical composition of those galaxies and how their gas is moving in the galaxies and what types of stars are in the galaxies and things like that. And anyways, though, we hit it off and boom, I started working with them right away. And I stayed with that same research group all the way through until I graduated.
So what were some of the outcomes or highlights of the research that you ended up doing there?
Well, you know, there's always this question, do you go for variety of experience, which has its own virtues and merits, or do you go for depth of experience, which also has its own virtues and merits? And I decided, knowing what I knew about myself dispositionally, remember, it was a big leap for me to go 5 hours away from home. I decided, you know what, that I was doing really interesting work in the Quasar Research Group. I loved working with my faculty mentors. They were giving me a lot of opportunities. You know, they sent me on observing trips. I went to Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona with them. And so I was working on cutting edge data sets. So I decided that I was just going to stay in this research group and kind of go deep into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result of that, I ended up with a number of publications that came out of this work. And I presented some of my work at the American Astronomical Society conference, which is the National Organization of Astronomers. And I actually won the inaugural Student Achievement Medal, called the Chambliss Student Achievement Medal of the American Astronomical Society. From, you know, I think partly because I had such a rich understanding and basis of work that I was presenting. So some of the work that I did in that research group actually made it into my PhD thesis as well. So, and that work, some of the work also was used as the basis for my research group as a whole for their applications for time on the Hubble Space Telescope and other prominent research grade telescopes. So I think that they're, you know, I feel really good about the work that I did as an undergrad, that it actually was used for professional grade research astronomy. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome, right? How often does that happen? I don't know, but this is pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you though, one thing I want to mention, you know, I almost quit the group my first summer working in the group. Mm-hmm. And that's because I was working on a data set that turns out the data set had flaws in it. It was a new telescope, and my advisors had gotten data that was kind of pushing the sensitivity limit of the telescope. So the data were supposed to be kind of pushing the boundary of what you could do with this telescope. Mm-hmm. And anyways, though, I was so dejected after months of working on this data, I was getting nowhere. And I was like, you know what, maybe research isn't for me. Maybe I'm just not smart enough, you know? And I really credit my advisors for talking to me and being like, look, this is part of being a scientist. Like, it happens. And it's not you. It's because nature is really complicated and these instruments are really complicated. And, you know, we ended up switching it up some of the projects that I worked on, and I felt better about myself as I was making more progress. But I really carry that with me sometimes. Even now, when I do hard things, I remind myself, you know, I can do hard things and persevere. And also, sometimes it's not me. Sometimes it's just the data are bad, and there's nothing you can do about that, you know? So so I'm glad that I stuck with it.
So when did you decide to apply for the Goldwater Scholarship? How did you hear about it, and why did you apply?
Yeah, so again, this is different than it is today at the University of Pittsburgh. But back when I was there, I did not know about the Goldwater Scholarship. I was just, you know, living my life, doing my research in my astronomy, you know, in the astronomy department, the physics and astronomy department, you know, all of that. And at the time, it's still true today that the Goldwater, there's a limited number of nominations that an institution can make for students to apply to the Goldwater. And so what had happened is about a week before the deadline, the dean of the Honors College, who happened to also be a physicist, He came up to me and he says, "Well, how's your Goldwater application going?" And I said, "What? What is this?" And he just he assumed, because I'm, you know, winning these awards and stuff, he's like, "I just thought you were doing this." I was like, "I didn't know about it." Which again, to be clear, is not how this goes now at most institutions. And so it was just a flat out sprint to get my application done and come up with a research project. But thankfully, because I had this deep basis of years of experience doing research in the same group, I already had ideas on how I would extend my research. And I had a lot of projects I could talk about in my research summary and that type of thing. And I had built a lot of skills. So it kind of came together. But, you know, getting the letters of reference on short notice and all of that, you know, and it, honestly, I didn't expect it to work out. I just thought, you know, well, okay, this was a good clarifying exercise in like cataloging and learning how to just to identify and discuss the skills that I've built in my research time and, you know, and thinking about my future plans and that kind of thing. So it just really, I was so pleased when it actually worked out. I was just as surprised as anybody else that was successful.
Now, was this in your sophomore year or junior year?
Oh, so because I was doing a 5-year plan, the way that the Goldwater at the time, again, I don't know if this is true now, but the way they calculate your eligibility is based on how many years you have left to graduate.
Oh, I see. And, okay.
Yes. And so I technically applied as a sophomore because I had 2 more years, but I was in my 3rd year of study, which I would call the traditional junior year. Because I still had 2 years left to complete my degree program.
Okay.
So, so I had had, but because I started research so early, you know, I had 2.5 full years of research that I was able to discuss in this application.
If you were to speculate, why do you think you were awarded the scholarship? I know you had been receiving a number of awards along the way. How did this work out? Because it's a little more competitive, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, firstly, as somebody who now makes these decisions, I can tell you, you can spend all day, every day driving yourself crazy, trying to figure out the alchemy of how these decisions are made in the room. and so, you know, so I don't know, speculating on it. I actually still have my Goldwater application. And I have looked at it recently, when talking to a student. And I think now knowing what I know about how competitive national scholarships, at least how I evaluate them, I think that there's a few things I did that were successful. Number one, I was really clear about articulating what experiences I had, how I, as the student, what I actually did, and what skills I developed in those in that way. And so, I mean, that's kind of hard to figure out because sometimes you don't realize, like for me, you know, I talked about my failed project, right?
Because
I developed resiliency as a scientist from a project that didn't work for months.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that I really tried to do that. I think secondly, my application made sense altogether. It was clear. My transcript supported the narrative that I wanted to go to graduate school for astrophysics research. My research experience supported that. My personal statements, my motivations, my passion supported that. It kind of made sense. Me as a person on a piece of paper made sense. Now, sometimes that's hard for me because, again, I'm studying for 3 different majors that, you know, I'm doing religion and physics and, you know, sometimes it's hard because I want to tell the full story of who I am at all times.
Yeah.
And sometimes though, you have to be very clear about what are the specific questions and needs of this opportunity before me and how do I present myself in a way that answers what they're seeking, answers the information they need. So with Goldwater, you know, focusing on S&T, I was able to focus more on, I mentioned those parts of me that are studying for, you know, philosophy and religion and history and that stuff. But it wasn't like a focal point of my application. So I think that made sense, right? Like trying to have it all hang together and answering their criteria, you know, just making, they tell you, they try to be transparent about what they want and need with asking these questions in the application. So you just answer them.
Cool.
That's my guess.
What kind of difference did this make to your undergraduate experience and career getting the Goldwater Scholarship?
Yeah, so it made a difference in a few ways. Number one, it gave me some more financial flexibility. Mm-hmm. So that was, even though I was on a scholarship to the university, my understanding is that's my Goldwater, the financial piece of it, kind of went into like resources to support me as a student. So that's beneficial. Mm-hmm. But I would argue though, perhaps for me, even more importantly, it really, it gave me confidence as a scientist. Mm-hmm. And it made me feel like, okay, I'm on the right track here. I actually am, the work that I'm doing, what I'm putting in, how this is being perceived by experts in the field, like it's all kind of connecting. This mm-hmm. makes sense. Like what I'm putting out, they're picking up, kind of thing. And that is not to say that you need to have external validation to feel confident in your skills and abilities, but just for me at that point in my life where I was at, that made a difference to me.
Let's segue over to your major. I mean, physics and astronomy, I guess, was a given the way you kind of came, or when you came to college, but tell us a little bit about whether that journey itself was smooth and as a straight a line as you thought it was. And then the other aspect, which is religious studies, how did that factor in and why did you end up choosing to major in both these topics?
Yeah, so the story I'm about to tell you is a great mm-hmm. example of how going through a national scholarship application process can help you become clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it. Because mm-hmm. I'm out there following my curiosity, right? So the baseline answer of, you know, 18 to 22 year old Anna doing these things was, I'm just curious. So I'm just taking a bunch of classes that I find interesting. And of course, you know, I have at the University of Pittsburgh, there's, you know, as at many schools, there's general education requirements and that kind of thing, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, I always have an eye on these things and I'm wondering, well, if I take these classes in this order and this at this time, maybe I can get a minor out of it, or maybe it would add up to a major or something, right? I was always kind of keeping an eye on how you could piece these things together. But the baseline answer is, I was really curious. And I had taken a course as one of these gen eds with a religious studies professor. And mm-hmm. I thought she was so cool and so interesting. And what she was explaining about the origins of Christianity, I mm-hmm. could see what she was talking about playing mm-hmm. out in society, in American mm-hmm. society and in the global society. So I was really interested in this. So I just kind of took more classes. That's kind of the baseline answer. But what I came to realize when writing my application for the Marshall Scholarship, where you have to kind of write a personal statement and make sense of yourself for someone who's never met you, mm-hmm. I realized I really like learning about systems. Mm-hmm. And so I had my major in physics and astronomy, which is all about learning about natural systems. Mm-hmm. Then I had my major in religious studies, which is all about learning about belief systems, right? Mm-hmm. Which is also very important for understanding how our world, our society and government and everything functions. And then my major in the history and philosophy of science is about understanding systems of thought, right? Philosophy is about understanding how people think and argue and how those, the intellectual tradition, how it develops. And that also, that history piece and that philosophy piece informs what we do in society, right? Because we all have our histories, collective and individual, that we carry with us. And so that, I came to that realization when I was writing my Marshall application. I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. Man, good job, brain. This makes a lot of sense, you know? But it wasn't like I sat down in my sophomore year and said, wow, I'm really a systems thinker, and let me see if I can put together a group of majors that will address the major systems governing American society or global society. You know, I didn't do it that way. I was just like, wow, I'm really curious in this. I'm just going to kind of follow that. And it worked out.
No, that's great. I mean, the idea of thinking systems is really good. I mean, really great. So, and I'm sure that provides a framework for a lot of people to kind of think about these things. So,
yeah, and awesome. You know, also we're complicated people, right? Yeah, I would say one of the big messages that I'd like to kind of convey on this is we're complex beings. And you don't have to just live in what you think or what somebody or society or the media, whoever has told you a scientist should be, right? Yeah. Or a philosopher should be, or a whatever should be, right? You just get to be you, and you are a multifaceted, complicated being, and live in that and enjoy that.
Now, you brought up the Marshall Scholarship. Tell us about that. Why did you apply, first of all, and what did you think you'd get out of it?
Yeah, so I mentioned how one of the reasons that I chose to work in my Pittsburgh research group for so long is because I was, you know, a bit nervous about going too far from home. So it kind of, perhaps it's surprising then that for grad school, I decided to apply for a scholarship that would send me to England, to the United Kingdom, where I'd never visited before. In fact, I had only ever been to Canada, but I'm from Western New York. So, you know, that's just kind of part of life up there. And so I just decided, sight unseen, to apply to go to this country that I'd never been to and an institution I'd never visited. And so I applied for the Marshall Scholarship because, so I was aware, because I'd been working in this research area for, you know, at that time when I was applying, 4 years, I was aware of the literature in these topics that I was interested in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it was fortuitous, if it would have worked out, whatever, but it turns out that the area of undergraduate research that I worked in is one that I found really fascinating. And I really enjoyed, you know, extragalactic astronomy and studying early galaxies. And so my research group at Pittsburgh happened to have a collaboration with a researcher at the University of Cambridge, who I'd never met, but nevertheless was, you know, we were aware of each other's work. And so when I was brainstorming, you know, here's this opportunity, should I apply? Not, my advisors really encouraged me to say, look, we have this great researcher over there. We think you'd be a really good fit with him, with his work that he does. And so I applied. And so that's how I applied to the Marshall. And I was successful in winning the Marshall Scholarship. And along the way, and especially, you know, once I lived in the UK for 4 years, you know, the opportunity has come to mean even more to me than I could have imagined prior, you know, from I was applying from a, like, this is a way to get to graduate study. And, you know, I care about being an American and the value of the political basis of the scholarship as a thank you to the American people for the Marshall Plan in World War II. Like, intellectually, I'd engage with that material. And I was like, yeah, this sounds good. You know, it's a prestigious opportunity. So in some level, you know, your university faculty advisor may be saying to you, like, well, apply for the biggest things, the most prestigious things you think you could possibly get, you know? So that was, you know, part of that kind of conversation too, but really it was driven by, I would like to go to this specific institution to work with this faculty member on this topic that I have been working on for a while and expanded in different ways. And so, yeah, that was kind of what drove my interest in it.
You know, tell us a little bit about what you did after you got your PhD. I mean, your career, you've sort of taken up a bunch of causes, and I think maybe it was curiosity or maybe it was passion or drive, but you've kind of engaged in a number of interesting areas, you know, especially in the policy area, inequities, etc. So tell us, give us a little feel for what you've done.
Yes. So while I was over there doing my PhD, I realized that I wanted to do something different than academic astrophysics research for my, at least for the foreseeable future. Now, I know a lot of people feel like that in grad school because, you know, it's, they don't just give out PhDs willy-nilly, right? You gotta really work for these things. So these are hard. So it's hard. But I realized as I was over there, I was spending a lot of time doing public speaking, public engagement. I also was, you know, I mentioned I follow my curiosity and interest. So I was volunteering and running for election to, you know, various committees, so the student representative of various committees within the university. And I realized, you know, I really like making a difference in these ways. I like this leadership piece. And so then I also, you know, was at the time when I was over there, I was there from 2007 to 2011, you know, American and British politics, it was a very tumultuous time. This is when Barack Obama was running for president with Hillary Clinton. They were running against each other, and then Obama was elected. And then we had a change in administration over in the UK, a big election over there. So it was, you know, politics was front and center. And I started realizing, hey, I'm really interested, you know, I'm a systems person, right? Really interested in how politics interacts with all these other aspects of our life. And as I was over there, I was coming, you know, I was familiar with how science is administered and funded from the US side, having spent time working on proposals and things as an undergrad. So as a grad student, I was learning about that from the UK side. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty different over here. They're making different decisions about what science they fund and who they fund to do science and how they do it. And anyways, though, also they'd opened a Center for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge while I was there. So I just started attending, again, curious, started attending talks like, well, see what they're doing over there. And I ended up deciding that I wanted to try to go for a policy fellowship after my PhD. So I had two policy fellowships, ultimately, one where I went to work for a member of the United States House of Representatives in Congress. And then that was funded by the American Physical Society. And then one where I went to work for the U.S. Department of State, running a entrepreneurship program that operated in 54 countries. Wow. And that was funded by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So I worked in the federal government as a policy maker, learning how the U.S. government functions internally, both from the legislative and the executive branches. And then I decided, you know what? I was working at the State Department and I thought, man, I'd really like to take some of these lessons and things that I'm seeing in the international context, like access, the inequitable access to resources and opportunities and how there are talented people, and especially scientists, right? Everywhere in this world, but whether they're able to fulfill their potential is often related to the systems in which they're a part of, right? Do they have strong education systems? Is their government stable enough for them to pursue research? You know, do they have the right immigration policies to allow them to pursue research? This kind of thing. And so I decided, you know, I see some of these things playing out in America as well. So I decided that I wanted to focus, then I wanted to get a domestic, a US-based policy position. And so I ended up opening the DC office for Northern Illinois University, where I worked for over 8 years, leading the university's engagement with the federal government. And and so in that role, I was able to take on some national leadership positions in science and higher education policy. And I'm really proud of the work that I have done in that role and that I continue now through my business. To help organizations and individuals better to advance their ideas and advance to live their potential and to better engage with the systems that they're a part of, right? I want to help people and I want to help them engage better in their systems, but I also want to help make the system better and more fair and equitable. So that's kind of the work that I focus on now in the policy context, but helping higher ed institutions and researchers get access to funding for their research, helping students, helping institutions help students be more competitive for national scholarships, like developing processes like pipeline development programs, strategic planning. I also do a lot of public speaking on these topics because some of it is just getting out there and letting people know, hey, there are all these resources and opportunities that are on the table for you, but why would you know? You know, you don't even, sometimes you don't even know to look for something if you don't even know it exists. So I'm spending, that's how I'm, I say that I have a speaking, training, and consulting business that I run.
Okay, so let's jump over to giving some advice for high schoolers. You know, you've gone through the gamut of things from intense research, going to college, getting a PhD after that, getting a bunch of scholarships, getting a lot of kudos, and now you're involved in this broader community-based work. What would you tell high schoolers as they think about college and as they prepare to go to college, maybe?
Yeah, that's. I have a few pieces of advice.
Sure.
So my first one is, it's going to be okay, right? I am working in a career. I didn't even know that the job that I have existed even when I was doing my PhD. Yeah. So if you were like I was, where I was always looking around, who am I going to be? What am I going to do? I need to figure out what boxes I'm supposed to be in, what labels I'm supposed to have. How do I relate to this world in all the different experiences that I'm aware of? I would say, you know, I recommend kind of navigating this whole thing, at least an N of one, a sample of one that's worked for me is I have spent time trying to figure out who I am, what matters to me, what I think I'm good at, what's in demand of the skills that I have and the interests I have.
Yeah.
And how do I connect that, connect my purpose and my skills to my profession? Mm-hmm. And that's something that really matters to me as I'm a mission-driven person. So that's something where finding your authenticity, finding your, being honest with yourself about where your skills are or where you want them to be, right? Because, you know, this is a growth, I have a growth mindset, you know? I didn't come out of a PhD in astronomy knowing how to lobby the United States Congress, but you figure it out, right? So being open to trying new things. And I would say another lesson is you have to be open to failure. And I can tell you, I think I might've mentioned it. So I serve as the lead STEM evaluator on the Marshall Scholarship Selection Committee that convenes at the British Embassy for the DC region. And, you know, we get 120 applications a year. We can award 4 Marshall scholarships out of the DC region. Mm. And I'm telling you, there are tremendously talented people who we just don't have enough scholarships. And so I would say in my own life, I did this exercise once. I wrote out everything I had ever applied for and checked off if I won it. I have applied for like 2 to 3 times more stuff than I have ever won. And not including jobs. Oh my God, if you're talking about jobs, it's even more, right? So I think, you know, coping with failure and understanding that you can learn from it and then move on. I think that's a really important thing. And then I would say one other thing, just following your curiosity, right? Yeah. Following your passion and your interests. You know, yes, we all have to figure out, and you may feel pressure from some people in your life to focus on what's going to get you the job, what's going to pay the bills. And some folks, you know, I realize that it can be an act of privilege to be able to say, well, I'm going to focus on my passion and let the chips fall where they may. So I think that if you are in a situation where you really feel that that pressure to really have that workforce job training component of college, I think that trying to find ways to make sure that you're aligning that as much as you can with your passion and your purpose, I think that that will lead to more fulfillment and happiness in the long run. And I'll tell you, I was in a job interview once for a fellowship at the State Department, which I did not win. I won a different one later, but for this one that I didn't win, They asked me in an interview, they said, Anna, where do you see yourself in 30 years from now? Mm-hmm. Now, I was a grad student applying for a position that I didn't even know existed like a year ago, you know? And so I said to them, I said, well, you know, I explained that. I said, well, you know, I'm applying for a job right now I didn't even know existed a year ago. So, you know, I don't know that I can, who knows what I'm going to know in 30 years. But they kind of insisted that I answer this. And I said, look, the only thing I can tell you is 30 years from now, I'm going to be happy. And then one of them said to me, well, I don't think anyone's ever said that their path to happiness lies through the U.S. Department of State. And then I said, well, what a sad commentary for your organization, if that's true. Right. So I did not win that fellowship. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, what you're going to be confronted, you know, with things like that. And I mean, what am I supposed to say? I could have made up something about, oh, I want to be an ambassador or something. I try to approach things with candor and honesty and professionalism, of course. But, you know, my honest answer was, I can't give you a true answer other than I'm going to be happy. So, you know, I offer that to your listeners as there is a path forward for living a genuine values-based authentic life that also leads to success, you know? But you're going to have to take some knocks when you're asked, you know, in an interview, where are you going to be in 30 years? And I made the choice to give what felt to me like the true authentic answer, which I think probably contributed to me not winning that opportunity. So, yeah, that's, I don't know. Is this helpful?
No, that is very helpful. You know, the point about where will you be in 30 years, you know, there was a time when very little happened in 30 years, right? And over the last 50 years or maybe even the last 100 years, that's not the case. So I think things are changing so fast that, you know, what you say is absolutely true.
Yes. We don't even, I mean, I work in higher ed, right? And in research and science and technology, you know, 30 years from now, we're, the industries of 30 years from now, some of them haven't even been invented yet.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
That's exactly it. Yep.
Fabulous. So, Anna, we're going to start winding down. But before I let you go, I'd love for you to share some memory or anecdote or vignette from, you know, preferably your undergraduate years, but really anything that you think might be of interest to the listeners.
Sure. You know, let me think about this. So I would say for me, asking about my fondest memories, you know, for me, I'm very fortunate that I have had success academically and, you know, in terms of winning awards and things like this, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, those awards, they're gratifying. They can lead to long-term benefits in my life. You know, I have opportunities today because I was a Marshall Scholar who did a PhD in astrophysics, and I was a Goldwater Scholar that probably contributed to becoming a Marshall Scholar. And, you know, so yeah. I think that so here's the thing though. I have learned over my years. I remember the defeats really acutely. Mm-hmm. I remember all the awards I applied for and didn't win. I remember those things. And I have to work hard to really make sure that I'm focusing on the positives and taking the wins and feeling and living in that moment when that experiment really works out that I've been working hard on. And when that problem set that I was focused on, or when that introduction or that conclusion to an essay really comes together that you've been really laboring over and thinking about. You know, I think it's easy to kind of blow past the wins and the positives. Yeah. And I think it's, you remember that one grade I didn't get well, and you know, all that stuff, right? And so I would say, so some of my strongest memories are these negative things. And it's my work inside myself to really make sure that I bring to the fore those fond memories and those memories of the positive things, because I want those positive wins. I want the you know, feeling great about the work that went into those opportunities and the support networks that I've had that have made those opportunities happen for me and those wins happen. I want to make sure that those are what I bring to the fore. So mm-hmm. I know this isn't like, you know, exactly like my fondest memory ever, but it's more like I want to be real with your audience about sometimes my strongest memories are not my happiest memories. And I work on making sure that I live in the happy moments and the successes and mm-hmm. try to bump those signals up higher for myself. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Now I'll get to a real fond memory. Mm-hmm. And my fondest memories of college are with all of the people that I spent time with. Mm-hmm. And I really, I'm a relationship person. I'm an extrovert. Mm-hmm. I really like people. And I, my fondest memories are when you're staying up late talking or you're working really hard on a problem set together, but like you're making like stupid insided jokes, you know, like physical yeah. puns at 2 a.m. or something, you know, like, yeah. Like those are the things that I really remember fondly, like most positively. And I really carry that with me. And it reminds me that I can do hard things and that I have people in my life who care about me regardless of what I achieve. You know, they've been on this journey with me and they care about me. That's something that really I have had to, that I try to really remember when I'm reflecting on those really positive college memories. I would leave it there.
Fantastic. So Anna, thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences. It's a fascinating conversation. You're doing great stuff and great work, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch and talk more. But for right now, take care, be safe. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hi again. Hope you enjoyed our podcast with Dr. Anna Quitter on her professional journey. One thing is clear when you talk to Anna, her excitement and passion for what she has accomplished and her drive to make a difference. As Anna made her way through college, her passion for astronomy and science evolved into a love for all things systemic, scientific systems, belief systems, and systems of thought. She won the Goldwater Scholarship and the Marshall Scholarship, which provided more opportunities to expand her impact. It is admirable that Anna is working in science and higher education policy realm in order to make a much bigger impact. She's also giving back to the Goldwater and Marshall Scholarship programs by engaging in the scholars' selection process. I hope Anna's story inspires you to not only excel in your craft or discipline, but also find ways to create a huger impact with your expertise. For your questions or comments on this podcast, please email podcast@almamatters.io. Thank you all so much for listening to our podcast today. Transcripts for this podcast and previous podcasts are on almamatters.io/podcasts. To stay connected with us, subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify, or visit anchor.fm/almamatters to check us out. Till we meet again, take care and be safe. Thank you.
College Matters.
Alma Matters.